a House Committee on Human Services on today, Wednesday, February 9th, 2011, and we're going to continue the informational hearing in a minute, but first I'm going to announce that House Bill 2056 will not be heard today and will be scheduled at a later date, and House Bills 2051 and 52 will not be heard today and will be carried over to the next meeting. Got that? All right. With that, I will now open the continue the informational hearing on the Department of Human Services. And Erin Kelly Seal is still with us.
Yay.
I hope you say you're saying that with fondness.
We are indeed.
Good morning.
We rearranged bills and everything to give you the time. We're so used to having you here.
Yes.
It's nice to see you, too. Good morning. For the record, Erin Kelly Seal with the Children, Adults, and Families Division. Appreciate very much that we're providing you with lots of information and really are thankful for the time to just have some conversation on an informational basis about background. And slowing down at the point we did on Monday makes a lot of sense because I anticipate this session that the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family Programs, the TANF program, will be a big focus of conversation in this committee because there are some significant financial challenges that we're facing in that program that will require us as a state to revisit a lot of our policy around that program and its delivery. So we already had covered this slide that just gives you the basics around participation in the program and what it takes to qualify. And I wanted to just, in this presentation, go back to 2007, which is the year that the legislature, in a bipartisan, bicameral effort, totally redesigned the TANF program last. There was significant conversation in 2007, largely driven by the fact that the federal government had passed the Deficit Reduction Act late in 2005, so not in time for us to address the issues in the 05 session, and of course we meet every 2 years. And so in 2007, in between the time that, in 05 and 07, the legislature participated actively, several legislators did, in a working group focusing on TANF, Oregon's TANF program, what the new requirements were under the federal law, and also what our policy objectives as a state were around the program. And at that time, what we really appreciated was that data I just showed you, that we have a lot of families with children in the TANF program who are at risk, and we understand, I think better, quite frankly, as I've been navigating with some other states, some of our demographic data around TANF to a greater extent, particularly as it relates to children. And the theme of the conversation between 05 and 07 was, let's not forget that, yes, TANF is an employment program, and it's also a children's program, because to be eligible for it, you must have children in your household. And there's a real opportunity for us not just to meet the work participation requirements, which is really primarily the focus of the federal block grant, but also to take advantage of an opportunity in those households, those parents with children and their lives, to stabilize them and focus on what the needs are of those individuals and their kids. So these were the policy and program principles that came out of the working group, which then became the legislation, House Bill 2469, that created the current statutory framework for TANF. So you can see there that the principles were that the responsibility around client outcomes was joint between the department, the community, and the client. So there was shared responsibility for both the employment outcomes, but also then for the family economic stability conversations that we were having and child safety issues. That we really wanted to be sure we were paying attention to the lives of the children in these families, and an opportunity that we had through this program to identify families that might be at risk of child welfare entry and to get ahead of the family becoming a family in crisis and maybe intervene earlier on a voluntary basis. That we understood that there needed to be very individually tailored employment plans for parents and also stability, family, overall family stability plans. and that because some of the barriers that these parents are facing, and you saw on that earlier slide, many face learning disabilities, many face drug and alcohol issues, many are struggling to keep their households together or are fleeing a violent relationship with a partner, that we need to be able to develop some processes through this program to assess families really pretty comprehensively and not only get them on the path to employment, but really tackle the issues that are becoming, that have been barriers to them being employed before. We looked at the service mix provided in TANF and recognized that if you just focus on what the federal government allows or counts toward work participation, probably wouldn't be able to address all of those barriers to employment because the federal government requirements are pretty strict, particularly around things like drug and alcohol treatment as being very time-limited in terms of our ability to count them as someone actively engaging in their employment plan. And we knew that the best practice data showed that, for example, 4 to 6 weeks of drug and alcohol treatment wasn't going to put someone on a path of stable recovery and allow them to become employed stably and for a sustainable period of time. And we needed to give ourselves some room around that issue and keep people moving toward employment. That, of course, we wanted to be able to sustain the financial stability for families and make sure that they were able to do that rural, urban alike in their own communities. And finally, we really believed that we could meet the work participation rates if we brought all this together in a very comprehensive, individually tailored way, while also meeting the specific needs of these families. What we found in the first year is that actually we were right. Oregon's plan was working. In fact, our participation rate at that point went from 21 to 34% in about a year's time of implementation of the plan, of the program. The target for the federal purposes is 50%. Obviously, we had a long way between 20 and 50 to go. But before adjustments are made in other states, at the point in time we hit 34, we were actually one of the states in the country with the highest work participation rates unadjusted. And so we were very proud of the progress we were making, and the feds were crediting us greatly with that progress around work participation. We'd also increased employment placements by nearly 40% within a year of the new program being implemented. We were serving people transitioning to work in post-TANF. One of the things we heard, I can distinctly remember a dad who testified in this very room to this committee, comprised, of course, of different legislators, talking about what it was like for him as a single parent with four children to become employed and to have that transition to employment where he was now going to independently be responsible for all of his child care payments, his co-payments, his rent, and all of those things, and that having a small amount of cash at the time, we were offering people about $200 per month for 12 months, was helping him to do things like meet that transition to his transition to employment needs and also keep his family stable as he made that very significant transition. We created a track for persons with the most significant disabilities who might qualify federally for benefits. And this was a voluntary track. No one needed to take it. But we had discovered that in the TANF program, people before now were being expected to work when, in fact, their disabling conditions precluded them from doing so. And so it was really bringing down our work participation numbers, to be quite frank, and it was very discouraging and depressing for the individual to know that they weren't really going to be able to accomplish the employment plan we had for them. So we created a very supportive program, which you've heard about before from one of our staff, where families voluntarily, we of course want to support them moving toward their employment goals if that's what they want to do, but they also can we also support them to become qualified for federal benefits if they're eligible, and we've had great success with that program. And we also increased our efforts around child support collection and pass those through directly to parents. Again, not keeping it before then, the state had entirely kept the child support payments, so we were passing through more financial resource and capital to the families themselves to support their kids. Then the economy tanked. So we had a first-year success story around implementation of the new program, and then suddenly job loss began to skyrocket, and the challenges that our poorest families were facing became magnified. Our caseloads increased very dramatically, which I'll show you a chart to. But you heard earlier from me in our overall review of our division that by about 40% over a two-year period of time, suddenly families were coming to us in droves. And remember, these families must be living at 40% of the federal poverty level or lower, about $616 a month for a family of three. So these are families, more and more families, who are finding themselves living in that extreme state of poverty. And we saw our outcomes as a result deteriorate. We began the biennium hoping to be at around 75% of our staffing levels. As you all know now, we're really closer to 67-68%. We had a group of people who were assigned to be case managers. Their staffing levels currently are at about 40% of the need, and their job description had always assumed that 50% of their time would be spent qualifying people for the program. And so now what that meant was the 100% of their time, because there were only 40% of them that we needed, was spent qualifying people, so they weren't able to do those upfront assessments, create those individually tailored employment plans for people, work in the communities around our partnerships with the jobs program. And our jobs contractors, this is important, we give millions of dollars to jobs contractors in the community through the TANF program, and over the course of the biennium, we were reducing, the legislature through rebalances and because of allotment cuts was reducing resources, not just to the department through administrative reductions and staffing reductions, but also then through the jobs program. And so our jobs partners had fewer resources to meet nearly double the number of mandatory TANF clients that they were being asked to serve. And so we created a prioritization of services document, and we, much like the Oregon Health Plan, started moving up the line, if you will, around what it is that we were asking them to do and the kinds of things they could offer families to individually tailor their employment plans for them. This is a very busy chart, and I apologize, but I thought it was important for you to be able to see the different program elements within TANF, and also then you could compare it to what we were seeing in terms of caseload increases for OHP and medical. Remember, the same staff who process TANF eligibility on the front end are also processing SNAP and medical eligibility at the same time, so it's the same group of people with a few exceptions in some processing centers. And you can see, so TANF, all families between 1207, the time the law passed, basically, and 1210 last year, actually, you know, because, again, the point in time that we started backed up a little bit, this number shows a 57% increase since the legislature enacted that new law and the redesigned program and the for TANF. One of the most shocking numbers, I think, for everybody looking at our program and our demographics is the two-parent household increase. In Oregon, you don't need to just be a single parent to be eligible for TANF. We've made a deliberate decision. We don't want people to have to get divorced in order to qualify for the program if they're living in extreme poverty. We looked at other states where that had happened and have found that often what families end up doing is they do ask one of the household members to leave so that they can qualify for the program and become a stable family for their kids. We chose a different policy path, which said it's okay for you to have a two-parent household, and if you're living at 40%, we don't change the eligibility criteria. The number of two-parent households qualifying for the program, you can see over a two-and-a-half-year period, has increased by almost 330%. So usually what was happening was that with one, at least if there were two adults in the household, one could maintain employment. And in this job market, it just shows how difficult it's been for families to have at least one person working. When you look at, again, to qualify, you have to be living in extreme poverty with kids. The mandatory persons, those are the folks who come in the door and who we must provide job services to, employment services to, and you can see that the caseload for our jobs contractors has gone up dramatically, again, at the same time that the funding to them has been decreasing. And you can also see the significant increase down at the bottom. I talked earlier about the driver, you know, in addition to the economy being a major driver for us, domestic violence is a major driver in both TANF and also in child abuse and neglect cases. You can see that individuals accessing, we have some special emergency payments that we offer to survivors who are fleeing their batterers. That number is going up. And you can see at the same time then our employment placements going down. Other parts of the program that have been reduced over the biennium include the post-TANF program. We've been gradually reducing that benefit over time, and so fewer and fewer people have been accessing it, also fewer people getting employment, so that's one of the reasons you see those numbers declining. And the family support and connections, that is a program element. I'll just four or five up from the bottom. That is a contracted program to providers in the community that we work with around children and families who are most at risk of child welfare entry. It's a budget. It has a budget box around it. It's a limited budget for a limited number of people that we can serve. Again, to qualify for it, you've got to be eligible for TANF, and then you go through a screening process that says, yeah, you're pretty at risk of perhaps needing child welfare support down the road, so let's offer you now some voluntary services. You can see that demand for that program or the enrollment in it, because it was newly created, that's one of the drivers here, has gone up significantly. There's nearly double the number of people on the wait list as we've been able to serve in actually the program. In other words, people who have taken a risk assessment, have been offered voluntary services, said, yes, I would like services, and then we have to say, I'm sorry, we don't have enough money. The contractors are saying, we're sorry, we don't have enough money to serve you, so you have to go on a wait list until we have an open spot. So people asking for help that we can't. So one of the stories that, one of the conversations, it's not a story, but it's a conversation we've been having through the interim committee process, is about the difficult choices facing TANF, because we know that we don't have enough money to fully implement the policy and the program design that came out of the 2007 legislative session because of the caseload that we currently have and the staffing levels that we currently have. And so we need to right-size the program, knowing that there's not lots more revenue to be able to invest in the program right now. What we need to be able to do, the department's opinion is we need to be able to right-size the program, make some tough policy decisions about who we serve and how we're serving them, so that we can help families be as successful as possible and maximize the benefits that we have in the program. What that really means is one of three things. It means that we serve more families with less benefit. That's effectively what we've been trying to do these last 2 years as we've managed through from last session, 09, until now, watching the caseload keep going up and up and having to continually reduce the benefit level for families in services and also our own staffing levels, administrative cuts, et cetera, while that happens. Serving fewer families with more, We could make a decision as a state that we're not going to serve as many families as we currently serve, but we're going to do it better for those that we are serving, and so we're going to reduce the caseload and say to certain families, I'm sorry, but you're no longer going to be in the TANF program, and for those who are in, we're going to start ratcheting up the benefit levels in some way, whether that's through the jobs program or more people, more money for family supports and connections, et cetera. Or serving fewer families with even less. And unfortunately, looking at the budget challenges that we're facing and the caseload, we have increasingly understood that we're probably looking at that last set of choices and the conversation around it as where we need to think about being when we come out of this biennium. We also want to make sure that this policy conversation doesn't ignore what we've learned before, which is that there will be consequences in terms of the kids that then come into foster care and some of these families that ultimately go into crisis. And we need to just keep an eye on that as we talk about these conflicting policy objectives, which clearly we support, which are let's keep children safe, let's keep families stable, and then let's help people get jobs so they don't need to depend on public assistance. So one of the things I wasn't attempting to tackle in this presentation today is the recommendations that are in the governor's balanced budget. But I do think I will say just verbally, and I expect to be back in front of you because we've got placeholder bills anticipating the policy decisions that are going to need to happen around this budget, waiting to know what it is that we want to be doing with the program. We've had many, many offline informational sessions with an open invitation to all legislators over the last year or so, where we've shown folks what do other states do, how do other states work on these programs. We've done extensive analysis over the last year plus about what some of the options are for us to balance our TANF budget and do the best we can to meet the policy objectives that we have in the program. There's no way to do that depending on the size of the budget box. I should say, if suddenly we had lots of money, we would be having a different conversation. But even at the current funding level for TANF, we're not meeting our policy objectives, and we know that. And it doesn't feel good to us as an agency to have to come talk about outcomes that aren't successful. And we want to be able to be sure that we're on the same page with the legislature about what the priorities are for us in the program and its administration. And so even if there were no reductions to the program, we would need adjustments in the statutory framework that sets out the expectations. And I anticipate, and now with the governor's balanced budget, it's very clear that even reductions from the current level are necessary in order to balance the budget. And that's going to mean that additional policy choices and conversations need to happen. So I know that the co-chairs have been thinking about how to manage this conversation in particular as it relates to the Ways and Means Committee and the decisions that need to be made about the budget, and I anticipate that we're going to be going into a lot more detail, but I knew that today was supposed to be an overview of the entire program area, so really was just trying to kind of introduce the frame and then, you know, of course, you know, be available and be back when the time is right to have that policy conversation with you about what it is that we're going to do going forward together.
Thank you.
So one of the other programs that we administer, which is really designed as a continuum from TANF, is the Employment-Related Daycare Program.
Before you move on to that, let me ask if there are any quick questions. I mean, what you're saying is so grim, I think it's hard for me to absorb all of that, which is we have a population in Oregon that needs more and more services, mm-hmm. and we're providing less and less financing to provide those services. And then there is a part of that, if we're providing fewer services to keep families intact, then we're in danger of more kids going into foster care, which is even more expensive. So it's sort of like we have a big balloon and we push it in one place and it comes out somewhere else. It's really a grim picture, and I want all of us to be hearing this and thinking about this, because Aaron is saying that we will need to make a policy decision, and then we will send that on to Ways and Means to ask them to financially support our policy decision. We'll be hearing from Ways and Means. We only have this pot of money, and so we will have to help develop policy that reflects that pot of money that they're saying that we will be having. So it's a very tough job we've got, and that's why I've asked Aaron to come and give us this overview and let us know what our tough decisions are going to be somewhere in the not-too-distant future.
This is that quote from Matthews, from them that it shall be taken, even them that have not. It really
yes.
comes very much to heart in this situation.
It does. Thank you, Representative. Any other comments or questions before we move on to employment-related daycare?
Got a quick one. Can you go back to that chart about and just say a little more about what constitutes a mandatory TANF jobs person?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I've invited Sochi Esparza to the table. She administers the TANF program. I just want to make sure the definition you get is 100% accurate. So could you answer that question, please?
Yes, good morning, Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam. My name is Sochi Esparza. I'm the TANF program manager with the Children, Adults, and Families. The term mandatory refers to adults that are required to participate in the Job Opportunity and Basic Skills Program. It's close a term as the federal definition of a person that must seek work or must seek other alternatives to become self-sufficient.
Co-Chair, if I may just expand on that. So a non-mandatory person receiving TANF, for instance, is a child. So children are not enrolled in the jobs program who are on TANF. We do have teen parents who we support participating in the job opportunity and basic skills program. But there are many children on the TANF program, and there are also children being cared for by relatives who receive TANF support for that caregiving, and they also are not required to participate in the jobs program. So if that helps, some examples of parents with children who we require to participate and examples of other TANF clients who we do not. We could get you the definition of writing if that would be helpful.
Thank you so much. Any other quick questions or comments? All right, thank you.
Employment-related daycare, as I mentioned, is an extension of TANF. We do provide child care supports through the TANF program because in order to participate in job or work, when you have children in TANF, we help support your child care. As an extension of that, once a person is employed, Oregon has made a policy decision that for very low-income people, we want to support their employment, and often we hear from low-income people that the cost to provide child care to their children is sometimes almost equivalent to the income they're generating in their employment opportunity, and so it's a Hobson's choice for them. Do they not work and stay home with their children because they can't afford child care, or do they work and support their family? Oregon has created this program in support of them, of low-income people being able to work, and we've extended the eligibility criteria, and many states, most states have the same opportunities and the same programs for these, for very good, obviously, policy reasons that often some of these families, if they didn't have these access to these supports, would be back on the TANF. So again, this continuation of really helping people to help themselves and be self-sufficient. So families with incomes below 185% of the federal poverty level, and for a family of three, that's about $2,883 a month, qualify for a subsidy as they're paying for their own child care. So just to be clear, it's a subsidy. It's not a full payment. It's on a sliding scale depending on the family's income. So families with lower levels of income receive higher levels of subsidy. And we also require co-payments. And so there are there's a financing structure around this that shares responsibility between the state and the client, and quite frankly, sometimes the provider. So some of our parents who benefit from this program are served in child care facilities who actually offer their child care services at reduced rates for low-income parents. And so the provider, the private provider, is then also subsidizing in partnership with the state the ability of a parent to have their child care arrangement be one that meets their family's needs. It is important to note that many of the families who are low-income who benefit from this program don't work from 8 to 5. And so if you're a parent who's had to access the child caring system anytime recently, you know that most centers are really only open from about 7:30 until 5:30, 6 o'clock at night. Some of these parents work odd hours, evening hours, overnight shifts, and they need child care when that happens. And so the ERDC program is one of the things, one of the programs that offers support for them to do that. We do partner with the employment department around this. The employment department licenses and certifies and regulates foster care providers, with the exception of a subgroup called Family, Friends, and Neighbors. And we partner with the employment department around some of our efforts, in particular relating to quality for the children in this population. If you think about also the conversation about Ready to Learn and the opportunities that this program offers, it's often considered to be sort of there are three major benefits to this program. You support parents who want to work. You support private providers having jobs and being paid, so there's a double hit to the economy. And you support positive child development through quality child care, child care by providers who are qualified to do that. A note here on this slide is that over the course of the biennium, in addition to the program reductions in TANF, there have been reductions in the ERDC program. If you look at the families that we serve, some of the options and the discussion during the course of the biennium has been how do we, particularly DHS, when the allotment reductions, those across-the-board reductions happened and each line item budget took the same amount of reduction. In the Children, Adults, and Families Division, we have our own line item for the DHS budget, and so that meant we were choosing among and between our programs, child welfare, voc rehab, self-sufficiency programs, to reduce. And it often ended up that the least of the most vulnerable families and children that we were serving happened to qualify for this program because it's the program with the highest income level eligibility. So we've seen recommendations that have reduced access to this program over the course of the biennium, and the program is currently capped. There's a budget box around it that's asked us to manage with a wait list the enrollment in the program at about 10,000 families. Right now, currently, we have about 9,700 working families on the program, and that means that that translates to about 18,000 children who are benefiting from the program right now. In addition, the program is supporting financially around 14,000 private child care providers through these payments. And so, again, it's that issue of the employment and the economy and the investment that we make and the community partnership. This isn't our own staff providing child care. This is really, these are private providers. There are recommendations to states about subsidy rates. We're not currently meeting the recommended level of payment to providers. Every year, the federal government participates in state-specific market price studies that look at what's the cost of care, generally speaking, in Oregon. And they set a rate, and they say the subsidy level for low-income parents in ERDC, they recommend, should be at about the 75th percentile of that overall average rate. It's very, and it's specific sometimes to, it is specific to urban and rural. And they make that recommendation based on a parent's ability to access care. So that, it, you know, in other words, we if we were only offering a rate that was 30% of what someone could be paid by somebody else in the community, they probably wouldn't accept a child who was receiving an ERDC benefit and that family into their, it wouldn't make financial sense from the perspective of the provider. Oregon right now is not meeting that federal recommendation. We're paying, the subsidy level we pay is at about 64% of the 2010 market price study. And we do have a lower rate of payment for those family, friends, and neighbors than we do for licensed providers in the program. So that's the 88th percentile. There's a lot of different percentiles in this program that are not always easy to track. But in essence, we also include incentive payments for those family, friends, and neighbors to obtain additional training so that they can improve the quality of care that they are able to offer in their home-based setting. And you can see that we do currently, there is currently statutory authorization for the provider groups that are represented in, who receive ERDC payments. They're currently represented by two union groups. The last major program area for which our division does have some responsibility, not in its entirety. I'm sorry, is there a question?
Just before we jump into the next program, I had two questions about the daycare.
Sure.
The first is, for working families, can you describe that a little more for us? Is this single-parent homes, or is this, you know, two-parent families? What kind of percentage does that look like? And then the second is kind of just more kind of my own curiosity. For folks who either aren't on this program, might roll off this program, does your when they come in and ask for this benefit, is there any kind of, like, I don't know, co-oping of, you know, we don't have funds for you, but we want to find ways to connect you with other parents who are in the same boat so that you could work out daycare swaps and some of these other things that you know, the families do, and just in trying to be an alternative kind of resource if you're having, you know, the money's not there to serve these folks.
Yes. Good morning, Co-Chair Tomei, and also Co-Chair Gillum and members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Prudzinski. I'm the child care program and program manager from Self-Sufficiency Programs. And the majority of our families on the employment-related daycare program are single moms. It's usually around 95%. And so single mom with two kids is our average family. And once they go off the program, I know a lot of these families, they are trying to, you know, if there's other moms in their communities that they know, they are trying to help each other out. But it's a real challenge for them at this point. A lot of times they don't have a lot of options.
Follow up?
Yes, please. I guess what I'm asking is, if you know you've got three families that live in this community and you don't have funds for them, is there anything that you were maybe possibly doing to facilitate a relationship with people who might not have known each other to give them that opportunity to connect and do this as a swap? Because they are working odd hours and weird shifts, and sometimes there are some synergies there that I would love to see us be leveraging.
Right. The Child Care Resource and Referrals, the local agencies, I know work a lot of time with parents. And then we have some real strong advocate groups, too, that are out supporting our families. And with our reservation list, we are going to be pulling names off of that on an ongoing basis. So hopefully they will, you know, be able to get child care through DHS.
Co-chairs, I'm sorry, if I may just add, if, with permission to Rep. Parrish's question, Erin Kelly-Seal. The reservation list, not having a totally open program, is very new to us. It just started in October of this year, and so we're just learning about what it is that we need to be doing with families around referral. We do have an ongoing partnership around the resource and referral networks that our workers are aware of and familiar with, and that I fully expect are making referrals to clients who come in when we can say to them, look, our only option at the moment is to put you on the reservation list. But here is a name of the resource and referral network, which is not in our agency. That's administered by a contract through the employment department. And we support families accessing those resources so that they can even find a child care provider in the first place, because that partnership has been there with us for a long time. We don't actually choose the provider for these families. They make their own decisions about that. And so referrals to the resource and referral network have been a common practice for us, not long before the reservation list started. That being said, I think we are learning about what does it mean to have a reservation list, how do we help people access resources when we're not available to them, and it's really only been in place about 4 months.
Follow-up? One more, sorry. I guess what I'm envisioning is something more of, if parents were to, say, opt into having their name be put into some kind of system where people could actually access each other in a non-provider sort of way, but actually more community way of facilitating relationships between these parents as a support system for each other to bridge that gap in a non-monetary way, but to do the facilitation piece of connecting people with each other to step in and, you know, be in the same shoes as somebody else and work that issue together.
Representative Parrish, we can get you some additional information. We'll check with our local resource and referral network and do that. One thing I wanted to add, University of Oregon, along with Oregon State University, has been doing some research of our subsidy families. And one thing that they found when they've done real in-depth interviews is that these folks are, you know, they're real resourceful, and they do, you know, connect with other parents in their area. So I can give you information on the study, too. That might be helpful.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good question. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Parrish made me think of an idea, and I know you don't have much to do there at your department. So I wanted to give you an idea, and then we'll just we'll leave it as an idea and explore it. But I happen to know from my experience in nonprofits that micro-enterprise, particularly in the developing world, is extremely successful, and it's extremely successful mainly, I'm sorry to admit, with women.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the best bet you can make in micro-enterprise. Micro-enterprise is not immediately applicable in this country, but there are those that are having some success. The culture is very different. Our whole materialistic society is very different. But Mercy Corps, who I worked with many years ago, is having some success in Portland. My question is this. Isn't it possible that a significant number, particularly of the single mothers that we're talking about and dealing with in this chicken or egg, how do I support my family and get my children taken care of and so forth, could go into that field if they were so interested? If we could provide, and by we I mean the private sector, could provide the micro loans to do that. In other words, they could actually become, Representative Parrish is talking about a support group on a volunteer basis, which I think is probably a more immediate solution. But what about them actually going into that field if they were knitted together with the accountability of a microloan and the capital to set up a licensed, approved, trained child care facility? Couldn't we make a dent in this problem that you're describing?
Co-Chair Gillum, that is a really good idea. There's lots of work that's being done with our child care providers to get them training. For our license exempt providers, we do provide a mandatory orientation, and there is training that is covered, and we provide stipends to those folks to get them more training, and so they can provide better care. And some of those do become licensed providers, so that is a really good idea.
And Co-Chair,
just to be sure, thank you. This is why she doesn't like me to have a gavel. I don't want to get us completely off, but just in addition to that, I want it to be clear. I'm suggesting that the very people who don't have employment and would like it, single moms, mm-hmm. could actually become the providers. Mm-hmm. The child care providers.
Yeah. And Co-Chair Gilliam, if I may, that actually is in fact what happens in this family, friends, and neighbors network of providers in this program. And my understanding is, but we'll get you some more information about it, is that it's one thing, which I really like your idea about the microenterprise approach. It's one thing to get something up and running. The issue then is the ongoing payment monthly to provide the service. And so it's not just the upfront cost of creating the capacity or the space or making your home, you know, meet the criteria and be childproof. That would be one way that I think we should probably partner more with the business community to see if we could get loans to women to help support the service. But the issue then is if they're serving their friends who are very low income, who no longer have eligibility for this program, the question becomes how are those friends or that support network going to reimburse them every month for the child care? And that's where this program has come in and why it's been a really important one, particularly for those family, friend, and neighbor networks, because that's exactly what they're doing. They're getting together. They're joining efforts to support one another and trying to employ themselves.
I've got Brooks and Thompson.
Thank you. I have a number of families in my district that I'm aware of that use Head Start to enable themselves to either have jobs or go back to school. Is there any possibility of partnering ERDC with Head Start and use those community facilities for extended care? Someone's already paid for the building and classroom space and that sort of thing. I know that they're not open in the evenings and weekends, but might there be a way to get them open?
Yeah. Representative Thompson, we do have contracts with several Head Start programs, and those provide full day, full year. One challenge we have is with the odd hour care, because a lot of times our parents don't fit into that mold. But we can look into that further. That's a good suggestion.
It's a foundation that's already there. You don't have to build a building. They have one.
Right, right.
Good idea. Representative Frederick.
Hello there. I just have one question. You mentioned the 14,000 private child care providers paid by the DHS through this program. What's the total number of child care providers that you have in the state? What percentage of the child care providers in the state are in fact involved in this?
Yeah, Representative Frederick, we can get that information from Child Care Division.
Give it to get a comparison.
Our staff, committee staff, and she will give it to all of us.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
Representative, did you have another question?
Okay, terrific. Anybody else? Good questions. Thank you. Okay, we'll move on.
This slide just is to remind folks of the role CAF has, our division has in terms of enrollment for the Oregon Health Plan. We don't make decisions or administer the program itself, but we do qualify people for it and enroll them in managed care programs most of the time, fee-for-service if those exceptions exist. And it's another area where in this time of diminishing resource where the need has skyrocketed. There were also policy decisions made last session to expand the program, the Oregon Health Plan standard.
Standard Program, which, as a reminder, serves only individuals under 100% of the federal poverty level. And we're also in part, we also are the front door for the Healthy Kids Program, the universal health care program that we now have in Oregon. I just thought it was would be interesting to for you to know that there currently are 17 separate medical programs for which our staff are qualifying people, and these are created by the federal government and are driven by federal regulation. Every individual family member, when they apply, may be found eligible for a different one of those programs, which is what makes the process of determining eligibility for medical programs so challenging. What also makes it very challenging, and I'd mentioned this before, is that we're currently using 30 to 40 year old technology that doesn't assist us automatically to make those determinations, so people are really doing them by hand. And they're having to, of course, and we take very seriously our efforts around accuracy. And so to be accurate and to manually calculate 17 different eligibility criteria for every different family person is quite a daunting task, which is why we're very thankful that we are working to modernize our technology, create an automated process. And also through healthcare reform, the federal government collapsed some of those medical eligibility criteria, which would make our lives easier on one hand, but they haven't yet aligned those criteria with the food stamp SNAP program. So once that happens, we will have reached the panacea, and I think we'll, you know, what we'll begin to see is that that workload model where you're timing how long it takes for people to do things, the need for new staff will begin to close the gap in our workload gap that we currently have for staff, because it will take people less time when they can use the technology. So I'm almost done. This is our last slide. It's intended just to be a wrap-up of the last many several days. And just to remind folks that, you know, we really are our programs that protect kids, preserve families, really support people to help themselves. We also invest in communities greatly, support jobs, create jobs and economic activity in your local communities. We've been very thankful for the policy direction of the last several years that is really a direction that is better for families and better financially for the state. We're very concerned about our ability to maintain that policy direction in the current economy, but we're we really are looking forward to working with you to do that and understanding together what we're able to do to maximize the benefits that we have to serve kids and families in the state.
Thank you so much, Erin. Any quick questions of Erin before she leaves us temporarily? I'm sure she'll be back.
Thanks.
Again, thanks. Colleagues, we have a difficult responsibility ahead of us, and so I want us to learn as much as we can about this agency, because we'll have to be making some hard decisions. We can ask Erin questions offline as they come up to us. We can also invite her to come back if we have other questions we want to have addressed. So keep that in mind as we move along, and thank you so much, Erin, for coming today, and we will, I'm sure, be seeing you again. So, we'll close the informational hearing on the Human Services Overview, and we'll, with self-sufficiency and TANF, and open up the informational hearing on seniors and people with disability. And we have James Taves coming up, and other presenters, I think, as he has seen fit. Welcome, James. Hi, James. I'm sorry. Are we losing him?
Right back.
Thank you. Welcome, James.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be back in this committee. And what I'd like to do is walk through the Senior and People with Disabilities Division programs, describe the services we provide, the populations we serve. Really want to spend some time talking about challenges and touch particularly around some of the challenges that will be coming up with the governor's budget and some of the redesign of parts of our programs to accommodate a much lower amount of revenue that will be available to us, and also talk about some of the federal issues that really are out there that will impact the decisions that we make and that you will all face through the course of this legislative session.
I just want to point out to folks that there will not be a PowerPoint. I don't know, is this available on for people who are paperless? They have a card copy? Mm-hmm. Okay, everybody has this?
Yeah,
we'll be working on this. Fine.
I apologize. So I'm trying just to walk through these slides.
Yeah, that's,
if that's okay.
Absolutely fine. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm just going to walk through each slide briefly and dwell on some and obviously respond to questions. The mission of the Senior and People with Disabilities Division is reflected primarily in two statutes, ORS Chapter 410 and ORS Chapter 427. The latter that is really the policy direction for people with developmental disabilities, and Chapter 410 is the policy direction for seniors and people with physical disabilities. They're two separate enabling statutes that happened in the 1981 and 83 sessions. And at that time, the Developmental Disabilities Program and the Senior and Physical Disability Programs were in different divisions and were then united in the same division in the reorganization of the department in 2001. But we still have two separate enabling statutes. But they are remarkably similar. They all stress independence, choice, dignity. The 81 and the 83 sessions kind of set all the policy direction, really, for long-term care that still is very, very relevant today. They talked about the state moving, and at that time we had very heavy institutional populations. We had large institutions for people with developmental disabilities. We had lots of seniors and people with physical disabilities in nursing homes, and the policy direction then was to do everything possible to create community alternatives to keep people at home, keep them healthy, keep them safe, keep them in small community programs and out of institutions. And you'll see as we go through here, Oregon has been able, through both legislative direction and leadership, and to make tremendous strides in accomplishing that mission. But those are the key words, independence, choice, and dignity. If you go, and I'll just slip over a couple of these. If you go to slide number 4, that is how the Senior and Disability Division is currently organized. Again, in 2001, we brought programs from three separate divisions together under one roof in that departmental reorganization, and then reconfigured how we did business, some based on population-specific programs, some on sort of generic kinds of things like the whole federal Medicaid program and licensing and regulatory control and things like that that are sort of generic to both populations. So part of the organization is population-focused, part is on functional kind of criteria. And it is divided into these basic five offices, all of the licensing and quality of care, and I'll get in more detail on what the state does there. The senior and disability services are for seniors and people with physical disabilities. Federal resource and financial eligibility, we are heavily, heavily leveraged with the Medicaid program. I think almost 70% of our budget in the senior and disability area is federal Medicaid dollars, with all the good things that come out of that, but also with all the strings that come with that. And really, that will help shape how we can move the budget around this biennium as well. And then we have developmental disability services and office. And then we have an office on all of our rate setting, all of our contracts with providers and counties and local government and area agencies on aging and our data staff. So that's basically how we're organized. And the division also has multiple boards and commissions over time that used to be independent and then were moved under the umbrella of the Senior and Disability Division. So we have the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. We have the Oregon Disability Commission. We have a Medicaid Rate Setting Review Policy Commission. And we just have a whole series of them that are created in statute that we then provide the staff and program support for. So what I'll do is try to split this in two parts. First, talk about developmental disability services, and then move on to the senior and physical disability services, because they're really provided out of two separate budgets and program areas, and I'll explain a little bit in detail the reasons for that. People with developmental disabilities, it's commonly includes people with mental retardation, cerebral palsy, autism, other kinds of brain damage or conditions. And the functional criteria is that you operate with a significant developmental deficit that's two or more standard deviations below the mean, which is all the technical terminology. But typically that's a person with an IQ of less than 70 or functional limitations that has a person that almost acts as though they have that kind of cognitive impairment. Many people with developmental disabilities also have lots of other physical impairments as well, but the primary presenting issue that we work with is their cognitive impairments, their need for lots of supervision and support, whether they're in the home with a family or in other parts of our service system in foster care or in group homes. For developmental disability services, we do all the eligibility for this population. We do case management, which is done through our partnership with counties. In most cases, it's counties. In a few cases, the state directly runs the case management because counties have opted out. We provide family support for about 2,000 families, in-home supports, directly respite care and support to families. And then we provide a wide array of community-based services for children and adults, and that includes group homes, foster care, semi-independent living programs, and vocational services. On slide number 6, it tells you the numbers of people that we support amongst the developmental disability population. 19,000 children and adults receive case management services, again, primarily through county organizations. 6,100 children and adults receive comprehensive, and I want to define the terms here. We basically categorize services in three types: comprehensive services, support services, and family support services. Comprehensive services are 24-hour. It's where a person no longer can be supported by their family, cannot live independent, and so it's a full 24-hour wraparound that includes residential living, either in foster care, residential care, transportation, and in many cases an employment program or day program that people leave their residential setting and go to. And we have separate, and I'll get into that a little bit later, we have separate federal waivers for these different programs, which is interesting that we end up operating so many different types of Medicaid programs based on the federal requirements. But that's the number of people we have in a full-blown 24-hour setting. Then we have 8,950 adults who receive in-home support services, and this includes either services directly with the family or a whole series of community inclusion activities. The reason for this, and we'll get into into this, we had a major lawsuit in 2001. We had large waiting lists of people with developmental disabilities. At that time, we were still busily closing Fairview. We were under a federal consent decree. We had the United States Department of Justice litigating against Oregon for years. We had spent enormous amounts of time and money at closing that institution, building a vast array of community residential services for people with really complex needs. And in the meantime, these huge waiting lists developed for people with equal levels of disabilities. They just didn't happen to have gone to Fairview, still living with their families, getting virtually no support. So we settled a major piece of litigation, and in the lawsuit we agreed with the plaintiffs that we would narrowly cap access to 24-hour care, because obviously that is so expensive. It involves three shifts a day and a very high cost. But rather we would phase in over the course of 6 years in-home supports, which is a capped benefit. In most cases, individuals and or their families get a monthly benefit of between $400 and $600 in some type of support, again, respite care or a job coach or some minimal transportation kind of services. And that's what we've developed since 2001. We actually renegotiated that lawsuit in 2003 when we went through a series of budget cuts during that recessionary period, extended the timeline. That lawsuit now ends in July of this year, and we're required after that that we cannot have waiting lists, that anyone who presents themselves has to be served within 90 days. So the developmental disability system at that point will be fully entitled, but the entitlement is only on a limited in-home or community benefit, not for 24-hour care, and that's been the source of a lot of angst in the whole developmental disability community.
I have a question, James. So when Fairview was closed and folks were moved into the community, what was the difference in the state funding going to those from Fairview into the community? Was it more expensive to put people in the community, more expensive to keep them in Fairview?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question. Most of the time, I'll say it was much less expensive, but in some cases it was actually more expensive. The cost at Fairview per month when Fairview closed in 1999, when the legislature made the final decision to close it, and it then closed in April of 2000, the cost per person per month was about $22,000. The costs were enormous. And that, again, was after about 10 years of litigation. The staffing ratios, I think, were 2 or 4 to 1. We had to hire numerous clinical staff. We had that staffing ratio, I used to joke, included 2 lawyers and a couple of direct care staff. We were just so tied up in that litigation. So the costs were just in the stratosphere. For most people that we moved in the community at that time, the costs were somewhere between $6,000 to $10,000. But then there was a small subgroup. We set up state-operated community services that now serve about 140 people. They have people with extraordinary behaviors. They have people, in some cases, that have come out of Oregon State Hospital under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, that have histories of sexual assault, a couple of cases of murders of people that are sort of in the post-Psychiatric Security Review Board jurisdiction, that we have to do tons of wraparound line-of-sight supervision. And those individuals right now are costing between $20,000 and $30,000 a month. So they're up, and in some cases even more than what the closing costs were at Fairview. When we closed it, we actually saved at that time about $50 million a biennium. And at that time, the governor and the legislature allowed us to reinvest those dollars in community services. And that was in part to help start services to people on the waiting list. So by and large, it was a very good deal in terms of the financial impact, but the costs have risen markedly for at least some subgroup that have very, very complex needs. And of course, now we have no institutions. Eastern Oregon Training Center was the small last institution that closed last fall. So I think we've joined 6 other states that have no institutions on the developmental disability side. So we literally have to deal with any kind of behavior or medical complexity on the community side.
So this small subset of 140 people who cost between $20,000 and $30,000 a year, where would they be living? What would that facility be like?
In the most cases, Madam Chair, they are 5-person homes or less. In a couple cases, they're situated side by side to economize on the staffing, but for the most part, they are 5 less in a typical kind of home with very high staffing ratios. Under Medicaid law, we can't lock the doors, and so for people that have significant behaviors, we have all kinds of alarm systems and monitor egress and site supervision when people actually leave the house. So it's a very intensive wraparound for that subgroup of individuals.
That's fascinating. Representative White, I know you have a question. I may follow up some more, but go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get to the lawsuit issue. Did that happen because of federal dollars that we were receiving and mandates from the federal, or were they due to state regulations, or how did the lawsuits come about?
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, is that the correct pronunciation? Thank you. Well, the two lawsuits. The one lawsuit was initiated by the United States Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. They first started investigating Fairview Training Center in 1983. They actually, we negotiated back and forth for about 6 years, and they actually filed suit in 89. And they filed suit under a federal law that's called CRIPA, which is the something on Institutionalized Persons Act. I'm sorry, I can't even remember the acronym anymore, but it actually allows jurisdiction by the United States Department of Justice to intervene in state institutions or jails. And at that time, there was a whole flurry of lawsuits across the country that tapered off somewhat. But they're still pretty busy, as most of you probably know. They've been present at Oregon State Hospital. They certainly haven't filed suit, but they came in under express jurisdiction that allowed the federal government to come in. So literally with the United States Department of Justice, we were in and out of court, then we settled a consent decree, and then we went back and forth to federal court over almost a 10-year period. The other lawsuit was and back to your question, no, it wasn't just because we received federal funds. If we had taken no federal funds at all, they still would have had jurisdiction. And this is kind of a long story, but simultaneously then we were getting Medicaid dollars, and the federal Medicaid agency came in and then cut off all our Medicaid funds in response to the lawsuit. So then we had marathon negotiations with two federal agencies and simultaneous with being in and out of federal court. It was, one could write a book about that. It was an incredible period of years. The other lawsuit, called the Staley lawsuit, after the lead plaintiff, was filed by lawyers here in Oregon on behalf of people with developmental disabilities and their families. So it was a state lawsuit. But they asserted claims under the federal Medicaid program that people have a right to institutional care under federal law, and if you don't provide supports in the community, then you have to provide a right in a 24-hour institutional setting. And, of course, we, like many states, says, well, we don't want to do that. Families don't want to do that. So we settled it by creating this limited capped in-home benefit. So those are the two, and we've had other little lawsuits, but those were the two big ones that have kind of driven our system.
Does that answer your question? Follow-up.
Kind of follow-up. So do we have any idea of the cost of what they did? Because, I mean, to me, this is a case of where the feds are kind of coming in and taking away money that could be providing services, where they should be coming in saying, hey, we want to help you get here and helping us fund these programs to get them moving. So I'm just kind of curious on how much they cost us and how much money we actually took away from the programs.
Co-chairs and representative, I'd have to kind of research that. I mean, and I wouldn't pretend to speak for the federal government at all. They would say, well, we present 60 or 70% of your budget to the Medicaid program, so we fully assisted you in meeting these costs. But, of course, there was, during those years, a huge impact on the general fund because every federal dollar has to be matched with a state dollar as well. So obviously, the budget for developmental disabilities in, I think, 1985 was about 80 or 90 million. Now, almost 25 years later, it's approaching $1 billion. So, and that's a lot of that has to do with the growth of the population, the caseload, but certainly there were significant federal drivers in that as well.
Thank you.
Good question.
Yes,
Representative Greenlee. Absolutely.
Talk to us, James, a little bit about the Staley, which wasn't the federal government, that was a local thing. And you do have an idea of how much we're spending on that program. And I've heard some sense that we may want to try and convert that into a regular line rather than dealing with it out of the, as a continued response to a lawsuit that's, 15 years old now or something?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlee, again, the Staley agreement ends, the formal legal agreement ends in July of this year. So we'll be out from under the lawsuit, and we will have met all the obligations.
That was a settlement, right?
It was a settlement that at the time Governor Kitzhaber and the Department of Justice, and we settled with the plaintiffs. But Yes, it will be out of, although it was a court-enforced settlement, so it was, the court had jurisdiction if we failed to meet our benchmarks. But again, that ends in July of this year. And at that point, it becomes a regular part of our Medicaid program. And our Medicaid program is for people with developmental disabilities then is split into two separate federal waivers. One is for full 24-hour care, which again, we cap and we triage. You really have to meet some real significant emergency criteria to get into that costly part of the system. And then the other part of our regular Medicaid program will be this limited capped in-home benefit averaging between $400 and $600. And we'll be discussing that as part of the governor's budget because there probably will have to be some changes in that approach given the revenue situation. But and I'm going to talk a little bit later, but the federal government, as part of federal health reform, has also locked down eligibility. So everybody that was eligible for the types of services you were receiving when the Affordable Health Care Act passed, the states have to maintain eligibility. So we can reconfigure some of the benefit packages and certainly move part of that program around somewhat at the edges, but the core eligibility for that type of services will still be required to maintain. But again, we'll be out from under the lawsuit.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Good question. James, how long have you been with the agency? I ask a personal question.
Co-chairs and Representative Tomei, I started with the old mental health division in the Developmental Disability Office in 1985 and worked in the Developmental Disability Program through 2000-2001 and then came to the Senior Disability Division when that was organized as part of the new department at that time.
And what I'm getting at is you were there in this process with Fairview.
Madam Chair, I was there through that entire process, correct.
Well, it was very painful, I think, for everybody involved. And I remember seeing something, I think, on your desk, James, sort of like a cage. I think when we talk about Fairview and the federal government being involved, there was a reason they were involved. And I think this is a very graphic example of why they were looking at Fairview. So it would be interesting to show.
Co-chairs and Co-chair Tomei, you're absolutely right. Particularly when we started in 1983, Fairview had probably the lowest staffing ratio in the country. For those of you who have ever been out there, it was built at the turn of the century. The latest buildings were probably built in the 50s. Had we stayed on that campus, we would have had to have done a massive capital project because none of them met code. All were grandfathered in under both state and federal regulations. So the environment was very poor, and then we had very poor staffing ratios on top of that. I have to say, though, by the end of that process, we had poured in so much money and so much staff. I used to joke that we had moved almost everybody out of Fairview and still couldn't find a parking place out there. And quite frankly, there was a point where the U.S. Department of Justice just piled on. At that point, many of us became very angry. So I certainly agree there was a point where clearly the conditions were deplorable and the state had not lived up to the needs of that population. But there came a point where, at least in my mind, it was just over the top.
I understand. Thank you, and I certainly did not mean that as any kind of criticism, either personally or of the agency.
No, Madam Chair. It's part of our history now, so.
Yes. Thank you.
Moving on to slide number 7, it just is a quick graphic of the caseloads in the developmental disability program and how they break out by county. The services for the developmental disability population are contracted through, by and large, county programs, although increasingly we are now under MMIS and under some of the subsystems of our Medicaid payment system now are starting to do a lot of direct payments and not contracted through local government like we did historically. The next page, slide number 8, is just a quick depiction of how the case law is, and you'll see again the basic division between comprehensive services, which are the full-blown 24-hour, and then the support services, which are a more limited in-home capped benefit. And I'll keep moving pretty quickly through these slides. Slide number 9, this one really shows you what we've done in the developmental disability system. The growth has all been on the in-home side. For 24-hour care, it's been relatively flat, and that was purposely so because of the litigation and also trying to keep our costs down in the most expensive part of the system. And then we have, you'll see the very bottom line, we have a couple of programs for medically fragile kids, kids with real significant autism or behavioral challenges. Those are called model waivers. They're even a different kind of animal under federal law. They're called model waivers, where we can serve up to 200 people in each of those waivers and not open it up as a full-blown entitlement and be able to cap it off at that, although we've been able to avoid waiting lists in those for the most part. But we have kids on ventilators living in their own homes, or we send in nurses and part-time staff to relieve the family. We have children with enormous behavioral issues that, again, we support the family in keeping that child at home.
Representative.
You may be reaching this at some point. I haven't gotten through all the slides yet. You haven't either. I recognize that. It would be interesting for me to find out to attach the same kind of information that you have in this slide to the map that you have of the state. Where do we find those medically fragile children in particular? I've toured the Providence Children's Center and seen many of them there, but it would be good to have that kind of a sense of, because it truly affects the school districts that are involved, because in many cases, if you have a medically fragile youngster who's in Lake County, that's going to take a great deal of resources for that district to handle that situation, and in Portland also as well. You can have a young person who's easily needs to have a lot of services, a lot of support, and that can be very costly.
Yes,
well.
Good point.
Thank you.
James, I'm going to have us continue for a while, but we do have two bills that I would like to hear today, so obviously we're going to have to hold you over to another day. So as staff and I were just looking, we thought maybe after slide 12, would that be a good place to sort of end your presentation?
Co-chairs, I'll stop any place you would like me to stop.
Well, the two bills that we have, one is defining the definition of defining persons with disability, and the other one is regarding unlicensed people providing adult foster care. You won't have talked a lot with us about elderly people, perhaps in foster care, but we can deal with that perhaps at a later date. So does that sound reasonable?
Yes, Madam Chair, the second part of the presentation is on seniors and people with physical disabilities. So,
right.
So slide 12 actually is the break between those two populations. So
that would be great. Thank you.
I'd be happy to do that.
Good.
Slide number 10 just talks about the challenges and the growing need for this population. Again, we're at about 19,000 adults and children enrolled in case management. They don't all get services, but they are eligible for services. We've been averaging about 800 new people per year just in the population growth of this particular population. The impact of autism has been very significant for us. I think you all know, I think nationally the incident rate is about a 1 to 100 in Oregon. We typically say it's about 1 to 80. I and others have been participating on a governor commissioned autism commission that really is looking at everything from education to family supports and transition services, but that certainly has been a very huge challenge for us that quite frankly we still haven't quite figured out how we're going to adequately support that population. And then our efforts to keep the growth and to cap 24-hour care is increasingly strained. We have now so many individuals that are themselves living with aging parents. We have, and I didn't do the count for this particular presentation, but I think we have in the neighborhood of 1,000 individuals whose parents are 75, 80, 85, 90 years old. And so their sons and daughters with developmental disabilities are in their 50s and their 60s. And, of course, when that last parent, surviving parent, can no longer provide care or dies, then obviously we have to provide 24-hour care. So the day is coming where just providing in-home supports is not going to work for us, and we're going to have a ramp up on the 24-hour side, which again has a huge cost impact. And we've not had typically, as we have in the senior and physical disability population, the average age in the developmental disability population, I think now is about 47 or 48 of the people we serve. So still, you don't have a lot of turnover. You don't have really high death rates of people leaving that create openings for new people coming in. So that, again, presents, at some point that will occur. The developmental disability boomers, I guess, if you want to call it that, will begin to even out that curve. But at least at this point, trying to keep that 24-hour system contained is becoming increasingly a challenge. Slide number 11 is just, again.
Just James, Representative Greenlee.
Very briefly. Jim, last session I remember hearing some very dramatic testimony on the self-sufficiency of folks with disabilities able to work and to live their life. Is the support for that, is that included in this, or is that in a different part of the budget?
Co-Chair, Representative Greenlee, that would be amongst the 8,000-plus people that we provide some in-home or community support. In many cases, and what we've done with that particular capped benefit that, again, averages $400 to $600, they have a menu of, since this is part of the Medicaid program, of Medicaid reimbursable services that can include day programs, vocational programs, transportation, in-home supports, respite care. So literally, we've tried to be very flexible to sit down with an individual and their family and say, here's your capped benefit, but we can really put a very customized plan together for you. And for many people, they receive exactly the type of services that you're describing. That would be employment supports or job coaching supports.
And, Chair, I'm sure you know about this from your career, but that testimony we heard last session in the Ways and Means Sub, and how important these services are to the lives of these people, it was extraordinary. It was one more of those sessions I ended up in tears. But
yeah. If
we have a little chance somewhere along the line, I think it would be an extraordinary opportunity to listen to some of the stories from folks that have a life only because these services are there for them.
Remind me of that, and we will do that. Thank you, Representative. Great.
Co-chairs, members, the slide number 11, I've described some of these challenges already. Supporting children and families is increasingly with the kind of behaviors and medically complex conditions is becoming a real, real challenge. Provider stability, we've tried to mitigate some of the provider stability issues. In the old days, if you went into many of our residential programs, you would typically see people with Down syndrome, a lot of supervision needs, but not a huge amount of care needs, and in some ways, as they were independent, our rates were very low. And so then we were moving people out of Fairview with extraordinary needs, and then we had people with not-so-high needs on the residential side. But what started happening then is, to again cope with the potential cost and growth of 24-hour care, and we capped it, and you can only get it in and on a crisis basis. So what's happened now is virtually all the new entries into our residential programs have significant needs that completely outstrip our outmoded rate structure. And then for a period of time, we were negotiating almost provider by provider, individual by individual, to augment rates, do exceptions. It became just a mess. The federal government came in and said, you got to have a rational way of doing this. And we then, starting, I think, two or three sessions ago, presented a plan that we've now rolled out, which now actually does an individual assessment for every individual, and it ties a rate specific to that individual. So when the needs change, the rates change, and that's really helped some of the provider stability issues. But in the governor's budget, we'll face some real challenges with those rates. And then I talked about just the delaying entrance into 24-hour care. And then just the last co-chairs is we do the licensing. It's all in one licensing shop, but we license developmental disability programs, group homes, residential sites for kids and adults, employment sites, foster care, just a huge number of agencies and providers, most who are nonprofit community agencies. Some are proprietary, but it's a vast network of nonprofit agencies that we do all the licensing and regulatory control, protective services, abuse investigations. It's also a function of our division. And that carries over into the aging and physical disability side that I'll do in the next segment of the presentation.
Great. And we will continue that. That's our intent, is to continue this informational hearing. I'm not sure when we're going to find the time for it. Let's talk a minute. Maybe we'll take a brief recess before we figure when we can have Jim back. Yes, Representative.
Thanks, Madam Chair. One quick question, if I may. With respect to your last slide about the licensing, are there any staff or services or websites or other IT aspects of the licensing which you share with other agencies or divisions within agencies anywhere in this state government? That we're also focused on licensing something else.
Co-chair, Representative Parker, am I pronouncing
yes.
that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. I'm trying to think. We share that information in the department, and in many cases we have a simultaneous or a dual license, because we have homes that serve people with mental illness and developmental disabilities. So obviously the treatment needs are slightly different, but in those cases we kind of do just a dual wraparound license. So we certainly share that information with the Addictions and Mental Health Division. We have shared licenses with the Children and Family Services Division, because again we co-license services for child welfare kids as well as kids with developmental disabilities. We have on the senior and physical disability side, and we're moving in that direction on the developmental disability side, a whole website that tracks complaints, abuse investigations by facility and by type. We're trying to load up all the licensing information and create a database to do that. And our goal is to have a consumer-friendly thing where a family member or someone looking for a program can go straight to that program and look at its history, both in licensing and abuse investigations of any type. That system is still being worked on and needs a lot of help yet on the IT side, but that is our goal, is to have a fully accessible website that really lets consumers and families track all that information.
Thanks for now. Well, to be continued.
Good.
I know we need to move on.
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. Any other quick questions? Okay, James, can you come back on the 14th? We figured that we might have some time then. That would be Monday, next Monday. Would that work for you?
I'm assuming co-chairs. I mean, we'll move.
If it isn't, we'll reschedule.
I'll check real quick, but I'm at your disposal. So.
Thank you. Thank you so much. With that, we're going to be closing the informational hearing on seniors and people with disabilities, and we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2057. James, I think we're going to keep you right there. Oh, go ahead.
2057.
Committee members, House Bill 2057 expands the definition of person with a disability for individuals who are served by the Department of Human Services. And it declares an emergency upon passage.
Thank you. Okay, now.
Co-chairs and members, House Bill 2057 was introduced at the request of the governor from the department.
Read the bill?
Re-identify.
Oh, I'm sorry. Re-identify.
Oh, I apologize.
Yes, re-identify. Thank
James
you.
Taves from the Senior and People with Disabilities Division from the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, James.
House Bill 2057, again, was introduced at the request of the governor from the department. We believe it's just a technical fix. This goes back to when the original enabling legislation was adopted in 1981. These definitions haven't been updated since that time. Originally, That legislation also created the Senior Services Division, which was pulling populations from multiple other divisions way back then. So some of the old, now outdated definitions from other divisions was simply melded together, and now those services have all been unified. And so you have old developmental disability definitions there that are completely out of date. You have mental health definitions that are completely out of date. And just the person with a disability definition that stands independent of those other two, that says anybody else that has a physical or mental disability is tied to the old income standard of supplemental security income, and is an old general assistance definition. I think I'm capturing all the old history. But in fact, since 1981, virtually everyone in the senior side, the physical disability side, the developmental disability side, the income standard we use is not 100% of SSI, but is 300% of SSI, and that's sort of general practice under all Medicaid programs. And so at this point in time, if we don't have a technical fix, I mean, we really have to go back and look at all of our regulations and the definitions that have been adopted subsequently in other statutes and reconfigure those. So we thought we would just sort of sweep across, replace that with a more inclusive definition that doesn't reference it back to the supplemental security information definition. Just for the record, the SSI, which is, again, a federal program, a federal definition, supplemental security income for people with disabilities. I think the monthly amount is $674 a month. For persons that are 300% of SSI or on Social Security, supplemental security income and anything else, the standard, the monthly standard for eligibility in our programs, again, at 300% of SSI is about $2,100 a month. And then no more than $2,000 in assets is the typical income and financial standard for entry into our programs.
Representative Greenlick.
That 300% is for everybody or only for people that have a home and community-based long-term care need?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlick, that's the standard for financial eligibility for Medicaid into long-term care. So essentially eligibility has two parts to it. For persons with developmental disability, you have to meet the income standard, be 300% of SSI or below, have no more than $2,000 in assets, and have a categorical definition of developmental disability. On the senior and physical disability side, it's the same income definition, but then it's based on your level of activities of daily living, your functional impairments. For a senior or a person with a physical disability, that's what gets you eligible for long-term care, is being eligible on both sides, financially and
follow-up.
I think you and I have had this conversation before. I mean, there was a particular case I know of, a person who was SSI eligible and put on the Oregon Health Plan. When they got SSDI eligibility, that income amount they had was at 87% of poverty, and they were taken off the health plan because 84% of poverty, not 300% of poverty, was the limit for the Oregon health plan part, at least, unless they had home and community-based long-term care needs and were receiving services for it.
Co-Chair, as Representative Greenlick, I remember specifically that conversation with you, and we've had multiple cases where people fall into that trap, and I have to recall exactly the details there, but again, the income standard is the entry into long-term care, but under federal law, if you're in long-term care, you are, I know it's confusing, categorically eligible for health care as well. You're considered to be part of the categorically eligible population. So that's a different income standard than health care. And I don't want to go far afield, but
that's okay. I think we're okay.
So there's even
we're in the deep weeds now.
Yes, right.
So I didn't mean to lead you there.
That's okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, says expands definition. What kind of fiscal impact is this going to have? I didn't see anything put online if we do this and if we don't do this.
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, it doesn't have a fiscal impact. We're not changing our eligibility standards at all. and we're still locked in under federal law with the same standard. So we would still use the 300% of SSI, the categorical eligibility we do now, and it would be inclusive underneath this definition. So we don't anticipate expanding the definition to include more people. In fact, we'll potentially be looking at moving in the opposite direction under certain circumstances. So at this point, no, we don't intend to expand services for an additional population.
This will be referred to Ways and Means to, or to, what am I trying to say? Fiscal. Right.
Right. Legislative.
To see if there is exactly the question that you're asking. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The new definition contains language saying impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. I don't see, reading through this quickly, a definition of major life activities. Is this state language? Is this compliance with federal language? And is that defined anywhere?
Co-chairs and Representative Harker, I can double-check that real quick. We have lots of different definitions of disability in different statutes. What we looked for here, and we consulted pretty closely with the Attorney General's office too, would be a definition that's both broad enough and narrow enough to accommodate the existing people we serve and no more, no less. So I think that is our intent. There are multiple federal definitions depending on what federal law you're looking at as well. And in the Medicaid program, different states use different definitions. But I'm sort of racking my brain here to think if we have discrete federal definitions that I could pull out that mirror this or that are different, and I can do that very quickly.
Follow up?
Okay, thanks. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've just been spending a fair amount of time in contract negotiations lately, and that it would be really nice if we had a definition of that we could reference somewhere that's either in federal or perhaps more appropriately in state statute. I think we could probably come up with a lot of different definitions of what major life activities means. But if you've been in contact with the AG and certified smart attorneys are on top of this and approving of this, then I will certainly yield.
Co-chairs, Representative Harker, this is Fred. I'll have him introduce himself. He is on our staff. He is an attorney. He's not our attorney, but he has a legal background, and he's done the work on this bill.
Do you
want to clarify?
Yes, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Harker. My name is Fred Stern, members of the committee. My name is Fred Steele. I'm senior policy analyst with DHS and seniors with seniors and people with disabilities division. The statutory construction of this definition it's in Chapter 410, and as you see in the bill, and it's the umbrella definition for the persons that can be served by DHS and SPD. And as Jane was explaining, for our actual programs and eligibility, those definitions are provided elsewhere. The major life activities question refers back to the definition that is actually the overall umbrella definition for all of Oregon revised statutes, and it's found in Chapter 174.107 if you want to look it up. But it is the definition that says if the term persons with a disability comes up in Oregon statute, and there isn't a definition in that statutory section, then this is the definition that applies. It's actually a little more expansive of a definition in that section. It refers to persons with major life activities as well as people that might be considered as having a disability, and I think there's one or two other criteria there. When we submitted this legislation or this legislative concept to Ledge Council, we had actually just asked for removal of that means test, the SSI language and the general assistance language, and Ledge Council was the one that came back with this definition to tie it in with the overall state definition that exists in statute that was put in 1989. And so then we conferred with the Attorney General's office to make sure there wouldn't be any unintended consequences.
Very good. That's
Thank
what I
Fred.
Wanted to hear.
Thank you.
I see it is here in Chapter 508 of the 2009 laws, added to 659A is a whole definition of it. I assume that. And it says things like caring for oneself, performing manual tasks, seeing, hearing, eating. It is very specific in that statute, which I assume we changed in 2009.
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlake, is it which ORS chapter? I mean, or which?
ORS
659?
659A
100 to 145. And so I'm not sure what that chapter deals with in Oregon law, and what my assumption is that it, the definition that you're looking at is specific to a particular section of statute in statutes. I'd have to look that up to answer a specific question of whether that would have any impact on our definition in Chapter 410 or in Chapter 174, but my understanding of statutory construction is that that would not be the case. But, you know, I don't know if that language comes from another area of statute or case law that might also impact. But I could look that up if you have a more specific question.
That would be great. And if you could get that information to the staff, that wouldn't be terrific. If you will share it with the rest of the committee. Thank you. Thank you for testifying.
Thank you.
I was just given a note that we will rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means if there is no fiscal impact. Any further questions? All right. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2057 and open up the first public hearing on House Bill 2058. Jennifer.
House Bill 2058 authorizes the Director of Human Services to impose civil penalties on unlicensed individuals providing adult foster care. It declares an emergency upon passage.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I want to introduce Julie Strauss, who heads up our Licensing and Quality of Care office, and have her give the quick explanation on this bill, if that's okay.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Julie Strauss. I'm the interim administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in Seniors and People with Disabilities at the Department of Human Services. You have in front of you our testimony and summary. This bill, House Bill 2058, requests the authority for the agency to issue civil penalties for unlicensed adult foster homes in the state of Oregon. Unlicensed adult foster homes present health and safety risks for vulnerable adults, and we're asking for statutory authority that mirrors other licensed facilities that would enable the agency to issue a civil penalty when we discover that this is occurring. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions? All right. Seeing none, do we have a list of people that wanted to testify? Thank you so much, both
of you. Thank you.
Oh, nobody else signed up? Is there anyone here who's wanting to testify on this bill regarding foster homes, licensed foster homes? All right. Thank you so much. And this will also, is there some, yes, there was referral here also to Ways and Means. So if there's no fiscal impact, we won't be sending it to Ways and Means. All right. Any questions, concerns? All right. Thank you. With that, I will close the public hearing in House Bill 2058. Okay, we have no other bills. Let's see, I just wanted to look for a minute at the agenda for Friday. Do you have that, or do I have that? On Friday, we will be meeting again at 9. And we're,
and then we carried over 2051 and 52, and we're having information on the agenda.
We'll be having an informational hearing from the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority, which is a very important one. A lot of this will have to do with mental health issues in the state, and we heard today about Fairview. We'll be hearing, hopefully, something about the Oregon State Hospital, which is the Attorney General, the federal Attorney General's office is also looking at the state hospital. So we'll want to be hearing about that either this Friday or at a later date. And we're having a public hearing on House Bill 2107, 2108, which is regarding delinquency. The 2107 is regarding mental health. And 2398, which is about contracting with prepaid managed health service organizations. So, again, 9 o'clock on Friday morning. And we thank you for the good of the order. Thank you all. Thank you for people who came to testify today. And we will see you again on Friday morning. Close.